Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Unlike so many other issues in America today, the urban affordability crisis doesn't pit red voters against blue, but instead is often a battle between urban residents divided along generational lines. Older boomer homeowners are often opposed to the new apartment buildings that younger millennials need in order to live in popular and often progressive cities. Randy Shaw, a longtime housing activist and director of San Francisco's Tenderloin Housing Clinic, has written Generation Priced Out: Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? It's published by the University of California Press and brings Randy Shaw to our show now. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Why did the suburban lifestyle become so desirable in the post-World War II years?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, Leonard, because I think when we look back in history, we're going to say that the period in which wealthy people moved to the suburbs sort of started after World War II, and it started already decline when remember the yuppies of the late 70s, young urban professionals moving back to cities? The children growing up in the suburbs didn't want to stay there. And today, you don't really see many millennials who have money eager to live and go back to the suburbs. So the suburbs have actually had increased poverty, and the cities are becoming wealthier.
It's interesting because that phenomenon completely reshaped the American landscape and highway systems, and then it turned out to be relatively short-lived. As the baby boomer generation ages, many are no longer able to live in their large suburban homes for both financial and physical reasons. So why are they having trouble in finding buyers for their homes?
Well, the suburbs are one thing, but in the cities, the people who want to move to stay in their neighborhood and want to move to a smaller unit are unable to do so because so many neighborhoods have passed apartment bans. You can no longer, starting in the 70s, they started to stop building apartments in so many neighborhoods. So people who live in a 4-bedroom house, they're living alone. They'd like to move to maybe in a fourplex, one unit in their neighborhood. There are none available because the zoning prohibits it. That's one of the reasons we have a housing crisis.
On the other hand, in some areas, for example, here in New York, we're seeing the developers building these huge high-rises where studio apartment rents begin at somewhere around $3,000, and they can be sold for $1 million. And these are in neighborhoods all over New York.
Yeah, they have places in New York along the west side near Chelsea that it's $10 a unit, $10 million a unit up, and each has a private swimming pool. And I discuss in my book that the really destructive, that housing doesn't do anything to deal with the real problems that people face, the teachers, the nurses, the firefighters who no longer can afford to live in the cities they work. And that's what Generation Priced Out is about, is how we get back to the middle class being able to afford to live in cities.
Well, I don't think a lot of people can afford to live in those high rises either. Don't most younger people prefer to live in or near cities and in smaller homes or condos?
Yeah, and that's the trend. It's been a trend that started in the late 70s, but our housing market hasn't kept up. So even in a city like my hometown of San Francisco, over half the buildable land, you can build a 4-story mansion, but you can't build a triplex. That doesn't make any sense given the demand that the millennial generation wants for smaller units.
So is that why people are often moving to poorer urban neighborhoods? Blamed for causing gentrification?
Well, when you don't increase supply and you increase jobs substantially, then the people coming for those jobs end up taking units which would used to go to people who earned less. Or what also happens in city after city that I write about is they drive they live in a cheaper place, but they have to drive an hour and a half to get to work, which is a disaster for climate change. And when you look at all the huge traffic jams in almost every city I write about, it's because people can't afford to live near their job, and that's a big problem.
Why have older homeowners although I don't want to just blame older people, I'm not a kid myself. Why have older homeowners in American cities often blocked the construction of new apartments in their neighborhoods?
Well, I think what I always say, the problem is that some of them don't want any development near there. They don't want apartments. There's a very strong anti-renter bias that comes up in these public hearings, and people say that we have to preserve neighborhood character, and that means not having an apartment or a renter, which is very classist. There's a racial component. And, you know, Leonard, I always say that, you know, people I know in Berkeley, they drive a Prius and they recycle their compost. They feel like they've done their part for the environment. And the fact that they're making people drive an hour to work, they don't think about it.
So these neighborhood councils and homeowners associations have enormous power over zoning and land use decisions?
Well, they totally control it. In cities like Austin and Seattle and Denver and Los Angeles, they have just enormous power, and basically they have enormous political clout. And so they are disproportionately older white homeowners who get involved in this land use. They kind of determine land use for everybody, even if it's not in the interest of the majority. And that's what my book is about changing. And we are seeing some changes that I describe in the book where increasingly cities are moving away from that, but it's a struggle.
Do you find that progressive cities, those that back minimum wage hikes, LGBT rights, and greater racial and gender equity are allowing and even promoting increased housing inequality?
Well, that's kind of the theme of Generation Priced Out, because conservative cities that don't care, they're not claiming to promote racial inclusion. They don't care about diversity. They don't care about working people. But cities like New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles and Portland, they all pride themselves on being inclusive cities. They all pride themselves. They say they want racial diversity, but their land use policies are inconsistent with that, and that's what I'm trying to change with this book.
Why are developers able to get financing for high-rise towers in the downtown areas, but denied approval to build fourplexes, which you call the missing middle of housing?
Right. Well, it's because Wall Street and the big developers and the big corporate interests are able to get financing and build these luxury condos for foreign visitors who come in every weekend in New York City, so once a year, so they can have a place. They don't have to stay in a hotel. They can stay in their condo. But it's harder to get financing if you just want to build the kind of housing that the middle class needs. And that's also because it's very difficult. You can only build it in certain neighborhoods, and that makes it harder to get financing.
Couldn't the available housing stock in many neighborhoods be doubled without any additional construction if owners of single-family homes were allowed to create an additional rental unit in their homes?
Well, what's called ADUs, which you and I used to know as in-law or granny apartments, they're really being pushed. But even in a place like Los Angeles, the big hillside homeowner groups are trying to stop even that. I know that I was in Boulder just last week, Boulder, Colorado, and they limit how many of those units you can have in a neighborhood, only 20% of the units. It makes absolutely no sense. But even there's this hostility toward renters that is under the surface, but which comes out in these zoning meetings.
They limit it by law?
Yes. Hard to believe, huh?
You open your book with a story that may not be familiar to many people in this area about the ghost ship fire in Oakland in 2016.
That's what led me to write Generation Priced Out, because, you know, 36 people died in a warehouse fire in Oakland on that night. And, you know, the fact that people were living in Oakland without safe and habitable housing really was shocking, considering that Oakland was always the affordable alternative to San Francisco. It's the place where artists and bohemians could always go. And then you find out they can't even get safe housing there. What are our blue cities doing wrong? That's how I concluded from that something's very wrong when Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley, Seattle, all the cities I write about in the book, New York, all these cities that say they want diversity, and yet it's not happening.
Oakland also is a city that has always had a strong presence of people of color. If America's urban poor were mostly whites, would they get more support from politicians?
Well, that's a very interesting point. I mean, officially, this government of Oakland, I write about this in Generation Priced Out, the government of Oakland is very concerned about the decline in African Americans, very concerned.
Yet they're moving out? Where are they moving to?
Well, a lot of them were displaced because they can't afford the rents, but also in the 2007, 2008, when the foreclosure thing, a lot of them were buying houses like in the suburbs, places called Pittsburgh and Antioch that your listeners probably never heard of, just in the Contra Costa County, because they just could get a good deal in those. Remember, before these were the houses that ended up being foreclosed upon. But people who are African American who aren't under rent control in Oakland, the population of those who can afford the current rents and the current home prices, that's really the challenge. The people buying the new houses and filling up in new rental units are not African American.
Does transportation pick up the slack? For example, if somebody's forced to live in Walnut Creek or some of the other outlying areas?
Some people move to those areas because you can take BART to San Francisco from there. But then again, it becomes so pricey even in those areas, they're going to places like Vallejo and Fairfield. That's why I say 120,000 people drive from Sacramento an hour and a half to the Bay Area for jobs every day. And that's just not, I mean, it's terrible for climate change, terrible for their lives, and they're missing 3 hours of their lives and in traffic each day.
I thought that public transportation was supposed to pick up the slack and end that. Wasn't that what Los Angeles did in the days when you could see the air?
I grew up in L.A., and it was a mantra in the 1960s when I was growing up that L.A. doesn't need public transit. It won't work here. And by not building it, it created some of the worst traffic jams in the world. The number of people who have to commute to downtown jobs is just astounding. They've added some lines. They've added some light rail, but they go from like place to place. It's not like New York City where you can kind of go everywhere. It's like if you're going to one place to another neighborhood, those two connect, but not the adjacent neighborhood.
Weren't housing prices in San Francisco quite reasonable in the 1960s during the so-called Summer of Love? Groups like the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead could rent large Victorian houses for low rents and work on their music.
San Francisco was extraordinarily affordable in the 60s. New York was more affordable in the 60s, too. By the late 70s, as I describe in the book, San Francisco began to change, and it's been on an upward trajectory ever since.
And do we know what the factors are? It can't just be that older people don't want young people to have apartments in their neighborhoods.
I think part of it was the so-called yuppies, young urban professionals, the suburban kids, you know, ended up wanting to live in cities rather than the suburbs. We had a huge LGBT migration in San Francisco, and in the late 70s, that was one of the... You could be outwardly gay in San Francisco or lesbian, which you couldn't really be in a lot of cities, so people came for that. And, you know, San Francisco has just been very successful with getting jobs. So it was creating a lot of jobs, and so people were coming to the city for the jobs, but we never built the housing to match the jobs for the last 30 years. We still haven't done that.
So did it turn out that there were unintended consequences to friendly policies, including friendliness to LGBT communities and to the demolition of slum housing south of Market Street?
Right, and the massive, and the Western Addition, we also demolished all the leading black community in San Francisco was demolished in the 60s. I don't know what...
And replaced it with what?
Well, actually, it sat vacant for like 25 years, and they're still trying to figure out a use for it. It was mostly just designed to get blacks out of the city. Most redevelopment is next to downtown areas. This was nowhere near downtown. They took a beautiful African-American neighborhood and just leveled it.
Now, we're talking about San Francisco, which has a reputation for being a rather liberal town. So that didn't stop people from trying to get black people to move out?
No, it's sort of like Robert Moses in your city, that some things just happen. And what's shocking is that it was all done in a period of time where San Francisco and other cities in the 60s and late 50s were just kind of struggling for trying to figure out a way to revive economically. And so really bad and even blatantly racist ideas ended up being implemented.
At what point did the tech industry in Silicon Valley begin to have an impact on San Francisco's housing?
Well, it was really the first dot-com boom that began in 1997, like really forever changed the housing market. And then many people who weren't there in those days and moved there in 2012 and saw the second tech boom said, oh, my goodness, look what's happening to San Francisco. But most of San Francisco was left gentrified after the dot-com boom in the late 90s. So by 2001, the city had seriously changed.
I'm speaking with Randy Shaw on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. His latest book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. a follow-up to your The Activist's Handbook. What was that about?
Well, that book is about activism and how to use social change and the strategies for prevailing, how to work with politicians, how to do grassroots organizing, the whole bit. In fact, I wrote about a guy who just, in the Williamsburg, to stop the incinerator. It was a big campaign and in that book. But I've written a book about the farm workers movement. I've written a lot about social movements. But, you know, the thing about the housing, housing is such a core issue because we can add libraries, we can have bus service, we can do all these great things in cities, but if only the rich and the subsidized poor can enjoy it, don't you think we've kind of failed?
We're seeing in New York, as I said earlier, suddenly high rises being built in downtown Brooklyn, in downtown Manhattan, in Fort Greene, in Greenpoint. Even in Bed-Stuy now, there's been a move to knock down some of the older housing stock, some of the wonderful older housing stock, and put up high rises. And the rents are astronomical. So who moves into these places?
Well, I mean, you have the lower Wall Street, you know, hedge funds, Goldman Sachs and all. I've been tracking Williamsburg for a very long time, and I remember when it first got gentrified. And then after it was already completely gentrified, they demolished 100 buildings to make it even more so and more homogenous.
That was along the waterfront.
Yes. But they didn't have to demolish 100 buildings. It was already gentrified. But the thing about New York City, they do take things to an extreme. And then they showed in this movie called Gut Renovations about Williamsburg, they showed how all the floor plans and all these new buildings were the same. And it's like, it was just, which is just total homogenous. It's just, they kind of wrecked the area.
What's the typical rent for a studio or one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco these days?
Well, $3,300 for a one-bedroom. And, I'm involved in my organization. We lease single-room occupancy hotels. And for the first, we've never had to pay this much, but to get this hotel, we had to pay $1,500 a unit for an SRO room, just the rent cost. We're running the whole operation, too. So rents have gone very high, and that's why, you know, there's such pressure to build more housing. We have half of our entire city where nothing gets built.
The same thing is true in downtown Brooklyn, where the one-bedrooms go for around $3,300 and up. And those buildings, some of them are 55, 60 stories high. Most of the people who are living there are millennials. So yeah. I'm assuming that their rent is being paid to some degree by their parents.
Yeah, somebody. And, you know, the thing about New York City's housing policy, I talk in the book about this big campaign in Crown Heights about the Bedford Union Armory, where here you have this entire city block that's owned by the public. And here you have a neighborhood, Crown Heights, which is rapidly gentrifying. So it made perfect sense for the de Blasio administration to build affordable housing on that site, right? But instead, he proposed 57 luxury condos selling for over $1 million apiece on public land. Public land. Why would you build luxury condos on public land, right?
Well, I guess house the people who are going to work for Amazon.
Yeah. I mean, And I talk in the book.
So what happened on that site?
Well, actually, it turned out because groups like New York's Community for Change and Crown Heights Tenants Union really made a massive campaign, they were able to have no luxury condos and make it half of it affordable apartments. It was an incredible victory, but it took an all-out campaign. And this is for a mayor who ran for office saying that there's two New Yorks, the rich and the poor, and we have to, as if he's going to get rid of the poor version, because here was a perfect opportunity in Crown Heights, which has a long tradition of African-Americans. You know, that's where the Dodgers were with Ebbets Field and Jackie Robinson and all that. And then just to see the displacement and then say, here's this site we have in the heart of the neighborhood and we're going to make it luxury condos. It doesn't make sense.
Bill de Blasio ran for mayor on a platform that promised to end the tale of two cities that New York City had become. Didn't most people assume that he would implement affordable housing?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I describe in Generation Priced Out the reaction of Crown Heights tenants who worked very hard for de Blasio to elect him in 2013 and really felt, and they were ecstatic when he got elected because they thought he would care about affordable housing. But he's been a terrible disappointment in the housing realm. And since housing decides who gets to live in a city, he hasn't really changed much from the Bloomberg philosophy.
And it really did start with the Bloomberg administration.
Yes.
There's a lot of rezoning during those years to encourage the build these kinds of housing units put up.
Yeah, what's curious, what people often don't realize about Bloomberg, he's known for upzoning so many neighborhoods, but he downzoned the affluent neighborhoods. So he made sure that the rich people never had to have any apartments in their neighborhoods, while he took lower income neighborhoods or places like Chelsea and put in, you know, $10 million a unit condos. So it was a very one-sided use of the zoning process. I always say that Bloomberg and de Blasio have given upzoning a bad name. And I describe in the book how Seattle and other cities are doing it the right way, but so many people look at everything through the prism of New York City that they feel like, wait, upzoning's bad. Look what happened in Chelsea. Well, that's not how it should have been done.
Well, can you define upzoning?
Well, that's when you're allowed to build a certain number of stories and you can build more. And what many cities do, if there's like a four-story height limit, they say, you know what, you can build six stories or eight stories as long as you make a certain percentage affordable. But they're not talking about building 40-story towers that sell for $10 million apiece and then saying, oh, you can have some affordable units in a 40-story luxury tower, because that already has a dramatically gentrifying effect, just building that kind of building. And that's what Bloomberg did, the whole West Side.
And what happened when Mayor de Blasio extended the Bloomberg upzoning strategy to low-income, non-gentrified neighborhoods like East Harlem and Washington Heights?
It was terrible to see that areas and the representatives from all those neighborhoods opposed it. And de Blasio said, you don't understand, it's going to gentrify anyway, so I'm trying to help you. But they set income limits even for the affordable units that the residents of the neighborhoods couldn't afford. So de Blasio just did not really care about the public input from the people who elected him originally, frankly.
Don't those kinds of policies, regardless of their motives, perpetuate racial segregation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's good you pointed that out, because no one likes to be accused of doing things for racial means, but the implications are, when you do these policies, if they become fewer African-Americans and Latinos in those neighborhoods.
And the people who have moved out have to move into other neighborhoods that they can afford, it just making them more segregated.
Exactly.
So we're caught in this bind. On the one hand, if it becomes less segregated, then we're complaining about gentrification. And if it becomes the alternative is more segregation,
well, you know,
is there a middle ground here?
Yeah, I think there is, and I describe in Generation Priced Out that there are, when you add affordable, if you build market rate housing in already gentrified districts, which there's a ton of in all the cities I write about, there's plenty of gentrified areas. You should build the housing there, and then you can have affordable units so the working and middle class can get into high quality neighborhoods, and there's no issues at all. But these affluent neighborhoods have resisted any development, and that's what has to change. You can't solve a housing crisis by only building in the neighborhoods where you know, in the handful of neighborhoods in every city where such buildings are allowed. And what de Blasio could have done is not made such a big upzoning, but just do it in a more gradated way, like Seattle and like Austin's now talking about a plan where you can do six stories citywide, but 50% has to be affordable. That's a perfect mix. No one's going to say six stories is a gentrifying impact. And 50% affordable ensures the benefits of that increased upzoning are spread, right? And that's the way to do it. And that's what I recommend in the book.
Well, if these new places are so expensive, doesn't that exclude a lot of people, not just the working class, but young professionals like teachers?
Well, in the situation I'm talking about, the teachers would get the affordable units, because if half are going to be affordable, they would get those units.
They would get priority.
Right. Well, yeah, because they met the income guidelines for those units. By giving developers an additional few two stories in exchange for increasing affordability on the rest of the unit and some of the units, you open up opportunities in all of our neighborhoods for working and middle class people. And we have the kind of diverse communities. I think most people listening to this and most people in New York City would prefer to have those kind of communities. Yes, there's some elitist neighborhoods, but many people always say They really like diversity. They don't want their kid's teacher to have to leave right as the bell rings. They want them to stay after and do some special assignments and work with the kids, but they can't do that if they have an hour and a half commute.
Now, in a city like New York, we've had rent control and rent stabilization, although they have been undermined over the years.
Yes.
But wasn't that concept to protect neighborhoods in the way that you're describing?
Yes, and rent control is very effective for those it serves. Unfortunately, New York has so many loopholes and special deals and these renovations that are displacing people in Crown Heights and other places as we speak, where they come in and they say they have to renovate the apartment and they make sure construction goes on for years so people finally get fed up and leave. New York City needs a total rehab of its rent control law through the state, and it also needs far greater enforcement, because they're just like a big expose about the lack of code enforcement you've had in New York City, and that's unacceptable.
But there's no rent control in Los Angeles or San Francisco.
Well, no, there is. There is?
Yes,
there is. Like I say, San Francisco really has the strongest rent control and tenant protections in the country, but we also have the most expensive housing because we just didn't build any housing for 30 years.
And that was to some degree because people felt that they wanted to retain the quality of the city.
Because the homeowners in these neighborhoods don't want anything built, and they vigorously fight it. And there's all kinds of ways you can stop projects in San Francisco, far more than in other cities. You can file all kinds of appeals. You can hold things up. It's almost a system designed to get things not built in various neighborhoods. And so we have an entire side of the city that tourists often don't see. It's called the western part of the city, where literally nothing ever has gotten built in the last 40 years. There might be an occasional house or duplex, but nothing of any consequence, and that's over half the city.
And that's because of the laws?
Yes, the laws. The zoning doesn't allow it. When Mayor Feinstein was wanting support for her downtown development, what was called Manhattanization in the 70s and 80s, and San Francisco built all those high-rise office buildings, in order to maintain political support for downtown development, she told the neighborhoods, I'm not going to let anything be built in your neighborhoods. Don't worry. We'll keep it all downtown. So that's what's happened. When tourists come to San Francisco, they see all these high-rises and everything, but that's a small portion of the city. The vast majority of the city, the tourists don't see, nothing ever gets built, and that's why we have such a big housing shortage.
Is some form of governmental intervention needed for all new housing, whether it's government-backed mortgages or tax incentives?
Well, for low-income people, and I say this, my book is about how to house people who earn too much for federal assistance. But for most people in this country who have housing problems, they need federal assistance. They're very low income. That's why we have homelessness, and the federal government hasn't done the job.
In fact, if anything, there have been cutbacks in the last 2 years.
I've been in housing for 40 years, and ever since Nixon in the 70s, you and I are old enough to remember, Nixon eliminated public housing funding, and then Reagan decimated all affordable housing funding in 81. So we've almost gone 40 years with a HUD budget that is nowhere near what it used to be in the 1960s, and that doesn't work when you have a rising population and poverty.
And it leads to the kinds of scandals we've seen recently here in New York with NYCHA.
Yes. No, it's terrible. And it happened in every city's had that, because it's a combination also of the federal government for decades not giving enough money to housing authorities to maintain their property. And so we need government. I mean, a lot of states need to do more. I talk in Generation Priced Out about states who are blocking a lot of positive things. In Boston, in Massachusetts, the state requires a 2/3 vote in any locality voting on housing. So why should a housing development need a 2/3 vote of the local council instead of a majority vote?
Is there a way to show the homeowners that their NIMBY attitude is counterproductive? For example, when urban homeowners realize their children and grandchildren can't afford to live near them, does that make a difference in their acceptance of fairer urban development?
I think it is making a difference, and we're seeing that in San Francisco. We have a lot of Chinese-American immigrant families who like to live all with their multiple generations, and they're saying, wait, my kids, grandkids can't afford to live here. I think also the environmental issues, the urgency of climate change is finally seeping into some boomers, and they realize that fighting climate change you have to stop people from driving long distances, and the only way that you can do that is letting them work closer to their jobs. So the young people totally get it, And I think more and more boomers are figuring it out, and the Sierra Club's coming around, and a lot of environmental groups are really jumping on this infill housing as a key strategy for fighting climate change. So I think we're making progress. I do.
I'm speaking with Randy Shaw, who is a housing advocate and director of San Francisco's Tenderloin Housing Clinic. We'll talk about that in just a moment. This is Leonard Lopate at Large. My guest is Randy Shaw, whose latest book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. What's the nature of your work with the Tenderloin Housing Clinic?
Well, we started as a law office. I'm a lawyer representing tenants, and I've written a lot of rent control laws and a lot of land use laws protecting SRO housing, single room occupancy hotels. And then we end up going into housing homeless people. So we lease and manage and operate and do support services for 22 single room occupancy hotels housing over 2,000 people. We pay the rent for nearly 3,000 people in San Francisco. So we're a very large housing provider. We also organize tenants. And so we do all kinds of things with tenants and low-income housing in my job. The book is about middle-income and working people, but my day job, so to speak, is housing the very poor.
The poor often have been moved into SROs, single-room occupancy hotels. And what role do they play in the overall housing picture?
Well, I've been pushing the preservation of single-room occupancy hotels forever. And I used to be a lonely voice. New York's law was originally thrown out by the courts in this terrible court decision in the 80s. San Francisco's law was upheld that we passed in 1981. And so I rewrote the law in 1990 and got it strengthened. So right now, for a long time in San Francisco, there's been a broad political support for preserving SRO housing. So I'm very happy about that. Our current governor, when he was mayor, was very supportive of it. And so, you know, and still in some cities, though, you call them flop houses, and they call them, you know, they try to disparage the population. But in my neighborhood where I work, the Tenderloin, the people who are working hardest to improve the neighborhood are the SRO tenants.
Well, the Tenderloin District is located near downtown San Francisco. Why hasn't it become gentrified?
Well, I wrote a book about that called The Tenderloin, Sex, Crime, and Resistance in the Heart of San Francisco. And the short answer is we took a lot of property off the speculative market and put it in nonprofit hands, roughly 40%. And we also rezoned the neighborhood in 1985. So you can't build an office building. There's an 8-story height limit, and it has to be residential. We also don't have any ownership. The gentry like to own, and there's one single family home in the entire neighborhood and only a handful of flats. So you really can't be an owner and live in the Tenderloin.
Is there pressure to convert the SRO buildings to non-residential?
Well, you can't do it. We passed the law. Like I said, we have a lot of restrictive laws, and you cannot convert. You can pay money to a fee, but only in our zoning district, for example, in the Tenderloin, you can never be a tourist hotel. We banned new tourist hotels in 85. So one of the themes of Generation Priced Out people should really be thinking about is you have to be proactive in coming up with the land use strategies before gentrification is at your door. And that's why I really push. That's why that Bedford Union Armory, I saw it as a great example of, hey, gentrification is coming to Crown Heights. Here's an opportunity for the city to get a bulkhead of an entire affordable housing project. You can't wait until things are expensive. You have to go out and acquire land, acquire property through public money. And even if you don't have the money then to build it, you've secured it and you've taken it off the speculative market.
In some cases, no matter what the decision is, somebody's going to be unhappy. You write about opposition in New York City to building senior housing on the site of the Elizabeth Street Garden. How does it happen that two of the city's scarcest resources, affordable housing and green spaces, have been pitted against each other?
Well, I have to tell you, Leonard, I'm very involved. I've become very emotionally vested in that campaign that I write about because I used to go by Nolita and I saw this architectural storage area. It wasn't a garden or anything. Then I heard they were planning finally to move forward on affordable senior housing, which had been planned since the early 80s. And I thought, this is so great. And then my next trip down, I said, what's this garden doing here? And basically, the owner of the architectural supply store decided to turn it into a garden so then he could make believe that it was some kind of lush urban space, as the New York Times called it, and they wouldn't be developed. But it was never a garden for years, for decades, until they started to move forward on housing. And there is such a desperate need for affordable senior housing. And I'll tell you, Councilmember Margaret Chin has just really taken a hit from the West Village folks and the people they almost defeated her for election because she wanted to make sure seniors had homes, and I think it's really honorable. I wish more people would follow her lead across the country.
But there are good arguments for community gardens as well, and recently the groups hoping to preserve the garden have filed a lawsuit against the city in an attempt to halt the project. Public hearings were held last week, in fact, and the lawsuit alleges that the city failed to consider the environmental impact if the garden is gone. Do you think these environmental arguments have any merit, or are they only designed
they
to keep
no
affordable housing from being built?
You can sue against anything being built, and people do, claiming that it has a negative environmental impact that hasn't been properly. And the thing about these folks is there's parkland, right, huge stretch of parks right near that Roosevelt Parkway, huge stretch of parks, right in the green space, right near Elizabeth Street, and the groups that are involved in trying to save the quote-unquote garden have never spent any time trying to work on those spaces. So your listeners would be amazed to know how extraordinarily rare it is for affordable housing to be built in an affluent neighborhood. It doesn't happen. I talk in the book, San Francisco, two different sites, affordable housing could have been built in affluent neighborhoods. They stopped it. The council member just said no. City after city, elected officials, local officials make sure that affordable housing is not built in affluent neighborhoods. This is a grand exception and be a real good model for the rest of the country. We can always say, well, they did it in Nolita. You should do it in your neighborhood.
The Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, one of the city's real treasures, is challenging a plan for high-rise buildings in Crown Heights that would include affordable units because the tall buildings would cast shadows that would be damaging to plant life. Has climate change given the need for more green space a moral urgency?
Well, what I can't understand fully about New York City, like 39 stories is really tall. And, I don't know.
Not by New York
that.
Standards.
Right. But, I mean, obviously, the Brooklyn Botanical Garden is a great resource, and no one wants to jeopardize it. So I'd have to learn more about how the shadows actually impacted and the like. But I think what you do see happening, sadly enough, is people who do not support housing anywhere find reason. They find one reason or another to oppose it. And if it's not because it's a garden, they're going to say it's the wrong location, or it's too tall, it's too big, it's the wrong, you know. There's a list of reasons to oppose housing that people come up with, all of which is like, it's not that I'm against low-income people, it's just that, and then you fill in a blank off a list.
And that's why we have NIMBY.
Yeah. And
not in my backyard. We want it to happen, but not in my backyard.
I don't use the term NIMBY because actually the people that I see at hearings, they oppose housing in anybody's backyard. It's not just their own backyard. It's not like their neighbor's building. They oppose housing citywide because they don't want renters in their neighborhood. And it's very telling that how often neighborhood character becomes identified with keeping renters out. It's very synonymous. But they can't go out and say, we don't want renters. So they say, we have to preserve our neighborhood character and apartments endanger that, which is the same outcome.
It becomes even more complicated if the proposed housing is for rehab or are halfway houses.
Yeah, I talk a lot in Generation Press about this video that I saw that led me to write about Minneapolis, and I was seeing all these people, they were breaking down and crying about this proposed project across the street from them, and I thought it must be a drug rehab center or a halfway house. It was a 10-unit market-rate apartment building in an 80% tenant neighborhood, so even when it's not a halfway house or a drug rehab center, people are so anti-renter, they talk that way.
Another New York City story that's gotten quite a bit of attention is the failed Amazon project. Wasn't there concern about the impact it would have had on affordable housing in Queens? In fact, it
Absolutely.
Has had.
And you know, people who read Generation Price Dodge should read about what I write about Amazon's impact on Seattle, which was rather devastating.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, I say in the book that that the competition to quote unquote win the Amazon second headquarters is actually going to find themselves regretting it, and I think the New York folks did the right thing because again, how do you have Amazon plan to come into an area with no plans to find housing for people? And just that would be an instant doubling of rents and home prices and all that with no planning. I mean, it's incredible to me, again, that it doesn't surprise me with the governor, but the mayor who ran as a progressive, I don't see how he can be deemed a progressive when he backed Amazon in this deal.
Well, they keep on citing the potential for all the tax dollars that they would get. And there probably are people with helicopters who would be very happy that a heliport was also part of the project.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is that tax dollars is fine, but at some point, who does it benefit? And if people are priced out of New York City, then they don't really benefit, right? And so, if they lose their homes, you know, because someone else with more money took the place. The Amazon thing was really ill-conceived. And you know, the groups, it's very interesting because that story I tell in Generation Priced Out about the Bedford Union Armory, some of those same groups using some of the same strategies defeated Amazon. So it was a forerunner for that campaign.
Well, what happened in Seattle? And can New York City learn from the Seattle experience, or are the two cities very different?
I think it did, but Seattle builds a lot of housing, and they're using density bonuses to increase affordability. They're doing a lot of good things, but they were building housing as fast as anyone could build it, but Amazon was adding jobs even faster. So you can't keep up with jobs, because you can just announce we're adding thousands of jobs, and you know, a month later, the people are there, right? But housing takes 2 years to build.
Seattle keeps growing. Do they have long-term plans to deal with their increased population?
Well, there's a lot of angst in Seattle because it's no longer an affordable city, and they passed this very comprehensive affordability plan, which is going to make a positive difference. But, you know, I think people, there's still kind of a trauma in Seattle about what they've gone through, and it was really driven by the humongous growth. Amazon has more jobs than the next 48 corporations in Seattle combined. It is the largest company town in the history of the United States, other than like an auto factory in any major city. No, New York has never had anything like this. You know, just think if one company in New York City had as many jobs as the next 48 companies.
Would it have been different if Amazon hadn't been offered $3 billion to move into the area? You would probably still be opposed because of its impact on the housing?
That's a great point. You know, I would be opposed, and I think the people in the groups would be opposed, but it might have passed if they hadn't had the $3 billion. On the other hand, many people pointed out afterwards that it seemed that the only thing attracting Amazon to this location was the $3 billion, that they didn't really have any clear plans. They're going to add jobs elsewhere in New York City, but they liked the idea of picking up this $3 billion.
Shouldn't it be the responsibility of cities to require tech companies and other employers to make allocations for housing?
I think so, and I describe in the book how Oracle bought a building in Austin, and it was like they didn't buy the building. Someone bought it for them. They evicted 240 low-income families, and then what is the building right now? It's an Oracle plant with a luxury apartment building for Oracle employees. Cities are not doing a good job at demanding tech companies support this, and if people say, why don't the tech companies build the housing? Well, why should the city needs to ask them? They're just a private business. If they're not required to do anything by the city, they're not going to do it, right?
Part of the problem, I suspect, is that cities have been concerned about the loss of businesses over the years. In New York City, used to be a major manufacturing center, for example. We had three or four major breweries. We had all sorts of other things that are no longer here, and perhaps they see this as a trade-off.
You know, cities have an insatiable demand for jobs, and I understand that, but you have to mix it, because if you just continue to take jobs without building housing, it doesn't work. I think the Silicon Valley and impact on San Francisco sort of proved that. And yet we're seeing it replicated in Denver, which does build a lot of housing, but in Austin, which hasn't built housing of late. And you know, Apple just announced at the end of the year, it didn't get much publicity because Amazon kind of took all the publicity, but they're bringing 10,000 more jobs to Austin. And no one said, wait a second, Apple, where are those 10,000 people going to live? Are they going to take the units that would otherwise go to lower income people? Of course they are. So, you know, Austin's trying to do some ambitious things, but cities are doing, and this is why I say in the book, hey, for all the terrible things Donald Trump's doing, for all the terrible things with the housing budget, these are local decisions we're talking about. These are local decisions made by so-called progressive officials in progressive cities. Why aren't they looking out for the affordable housing interests of the working and middle class?
Well, housing has traditionally been seen as a local issue. What about the role of the federal government?
The reason we have a homeless crisis in this country is because 75% of the families that are entitled to aid don't get it. I mean, that's just deplorable. We have to keep working on that and get a new president and get a new Congress and push this Congress to get more money and the like. But in the meantime, there's things cities and states can do. And cities and states that are controlled totally by Democrats are not doing the best thing for the working and middle class when it comes to housing. That's what Generation Priced Out is really all about.
Have any of the potential Democratic candidates issued housing policy platforms?
Actually, amazingly, Elizabeth Warren not only issued a platform, because frequently they issue platforms, she was just on the CNN thing this week, and she actually got a question about affordable housing, which I think it's the first time it's ever even been part of a presidential campaign, maybe since Roosevelt in 1944, because, you know, when Clinton and Obama won, there was no talk about housing. It might get a word about homelessness, but there's been no talk. And when they took office, there wasn't a dramatic increase in housing funding. We need to make sure the next president is committed to dramatically tripling the federal, quadrupling. Our new governor of California, Gavin Newsom, is going to dramatically increase the housing budget. We had 8 years of a Democratic governor who didn't spend any money on affordable housing, Jerry Brown.
But Gavin Newsom has also been seen as a friend of the developers.
He is, but he's also big on homelessness and affordable housing. So I think that the thing is he's committed to it. We just don't get enough politicians who prioritize housing. And yet that's the core thing. Kids can't do well in school if they have to move so often, or if they're homeless, they're not going to do well in school. And their health isn't going to be good. So housing is the foundational element for education and health. And we need to make sure people have that housing. We've failed, really, for a long time, way too long.
Often when we talk about the problems that this country faces, people cite what's going on in Europe. Are European countries handling these issues any better?
Absolutely. Well, Europe believes in what's called social housing, and we used to call public housing. Europe believes in the government owning housing, and that's the most cost-effective way, and they fund it, and they do it. I mean, they're not perfect. They have issues, but you don't see anything like the situation you have. L.A. has 60,000 homeless people on its streets. 60,000.
They're sleeping on the streets or on the beaches?
Yeah. Well, they're in Skid Row and Seattle, San Francisco has 7,000. I mean, no other country in Europe has what we have here, and it's because our federal government doesn't care. They don't want to fund it, and they don't care. And it's been true for decades, and it's really a problem.
Well, New York Skid Row, the Bowery, has pretty much disappeared as a Skid Row. In fact, if anything, now it's one of the hipper neighborhoods because all the art galleries are moving there. So where have our homeless gone?
Well, one thing that started under Giuliani is you move the homeless to other boroughs where the tourists don't see them. So if they're out in the Bronx, then people can come to Manhattan, the tourists, and say, what a great job the mayor of New York has done. There's no homeless people around, right? Because they make sure they take them to the other boroughs.
The squeegee guys disappeared.
Yeah, I always say that San Francisco doesn't have a Bronx. We don't have an East New York. We don't have a place where the police can take our homeless people. They'd have to take them across to another city, which isn't acceptable.
But in talking about cities providing housing, I brought up the problems at NYCHA earlier. Could those problems have been avoided without a huge influx of taxpayer money?
I don't think so, because they were very underfunded. And one thing I want to make sure I mention in this conversation is I will be at Greenlight Books in Brooklyn on Flatbush Street.
It's called Flatbush Avenue, by the way.
Flatbush Avenue. Okay. You know, I should have said Flatbush Avenue. That's terrible. Now I've lost all credibility with your audience, but Flatbush Avenue on Monday night. So if people want to talk in person with me or hear more, they can come.
Houston Street. Houston
Street.
Houston Street.
Houston, I know.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
My father was born in the Bronx, so I have that credit.
So you're going to be talking about this book and New York issues when is it the book
Monday
event?
Monday night, the 25th at Greenlight Books on Flatbush Avenue.
How can people who are concerned about housing issues try to bring about change in their own city or neighborhood?
Well, I think it's happening. I mean, you have a group like Open New York that works for housing. You have a lot of groups that I write about in my book, you know, whether it be New York Communities for Change, Crown Heights, Tenants Union, Make the Road. I mean, you have a lot of good housing groups in New York. You have people like Brad Lander, city council member in Brooklyn, who really works for housing, and Margaret Chin, who was involved in the senior housing in Nolita. But we're finding groups all around the country people are getting more active because they're affected. And you know, Leonard, when something becomes a middle-class issue, politicians take note, and now housing's become a middle-class issue, because when teachers are on strike in city after city because they can't afford to live, they can't afford even an apartment, they're living in their cars in Oakland and in Santa Clara and in Denver and in Los Angeles and San Francisco. I mean, these are our teachers. When you get to that point, politicians start taking notice, and I think you're seeing a whole new level of engagement, which I write about in Generation Priced Out.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, young, affluent, mostly white people are moving into cheaper urban neighborhoods, don't think of themselves as gentrifiers. They usually don't move with the intention of altering the neighborhood's character. If anything, they want to maintain it. And yet, that is part of this process.
And I think people listening should realize, because I talk in the book about the kind of boomers always blaming young tech workers when the fact is they're the victims. I mean, these young tech workers are leaving college owing maybe $100,000 in loans, which boomers didn't have when they were graduating. And then they come in and they have a rental market where one bedrooms in San Francisco are $3,300 a month. So yeah, they might be making $80,000 a year, but it's going to student loans and their rent. So it isn't like they're just full of disposable income.
How would American cities be different if people under 30 voted as frequently as people over 65?
Well, you make a great point. One of the things I argue in the book is too many cities have local elections that are disconnected from state and national, and that gets an older, whiter homeowner vote. And it's really important that cities have the same election calendar as governor and president, because then young people will vote. Young people tend not to vote in those off-year elections because they don't feel as connected. You know how that is. It would make a huge difference if young people voted. I mean, and when the politicians feel they only have to listen to older homeowners, they don't even care what the majority wants. It's who's going to vote.
Is this mostly a problem in blue states?
It is, because those are the ones that people are priced out of. I mean, you can go to Alabama and Mississippi or Oklahoma and have no problem finding an affordable apartment. It's the blue cities and blue states where prices have gone up because they're so desirable, because that's where the jobs are, the cultural opportunities, and that's where people want to live. I had someone in the book say, why don't you just tell all these tech workers to move to Idaho? Well, there's no jobs in Idaho or Nebraska. That's why people aren't there.
So is the answer to start creating jobs in Idaho and Nebraska?
Well, as I say, I think it's not going to happen. I mean, obviously, when you hear these tech companies expanding in existing areas, whether it be Google expanding more in New York City or Apple in Austin or Apple again in San Francisco or Facebook, you think, why are they coming to the areas where we already have a housing problem? And the answer is they go to the areas where they feel they have a workforce. And, you know, they're not going to Omaha because they don't feel there's a workforce there. That's just how it is. And so, hey, if they go there, fine, but it doesn't seem like that's happening. The trend seems more and more, so we have to adjust our policy. That's what the whole theme of Generation Priced Out is. We know this is the fact. We know tech's coming here. We have to adjust our policies. One thing that is happening is now in the Bay Area, we're going to those Bay Area Silicon Valley cities and saying, you need to build housing. And San Francisco folks are getting involved in the whole Bay Area, and they're getting involved in state legislation, saying, we're not going to let Cupertino, California, the mayor said they wanted to build a wall around the city and charge San Jose to build the wall. Did you hear about that?
No.
Yes, check it out. Cupertino, where Apple is headquartered, he said, we need to build a wall around our city and San Jose should pay for it.
Are there a lot of Mexicans in San Jose?
Well, it's a lot of Latinos there, yes.
That was a Trump joke. But okay.
Yes.
Anyway, we've run out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being on our show, Randy.
Leonard, thank you so much. It's such a treasure to be with you. Thank you.
Randy Shaw is a housing advocate and director of San Francisco's Tenderloin Housing Clinic and the author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America, published by the University of California Press. And my great thanks to Randy Shaw, to Deborah Freeman, who produced today's segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.